Welcome to Midday, everybody. I'm Sheila Cass. Thanks for joining us. Need a ride? Summon a driver with the Uber app or the Lyft app. Planning a vacation? Rent someone's home through Airbnb. Are you a graphic designer with time on your hands? Check out job postings at Upwork. Uber, Lyft, Airbnb, Upwork. These are some of the best-known sites that directly connect buyers and sellers of labor, goods, or services. These mobile platforms let people, with just the tap of a button or two, cut out the middleman, employers, and become freelancers. In other words, they can get a gig, a short-term job. The spread of this kind of hiring and the way it's replacing traditional jobs has generated the name gig economy, or the on-demand economy, the patchwork economy, the peer-to-peer economy. The extent of the gig economy is hard to determine. We'll get to that in a few minutes. But a study released by the Pew Research Center last month found that nearly three-fourths of Americans, 72%, had used some type of shared or on-demand online service. And around a third of those ages 18 to 44 had used four or more of these services. Those services include buying second-hand or homemade goods, using a ride-hailing app, or purchasing tickets from an online reseller. On the other hand, Pew also found that 89% of Americans were not familiar with the term gig economy. Today, we'll discuss what the gig economy means for the future of work in the U.S., what forces are driving the call for on-demand labor, and what can be done to boost economic stability for freelance workers. Our guest is Stephen Hill, a veteran journalist and senior fellow with the nonpartisan think tank New America. His new book is Raw Deal, How the Uber Economy and Runaway Capitalism Are Screwing American Workers, published by St. Martin's Press. Welcome to Midday.
Thank you, Sheila. Nice to be here.
I'm glad you could join us. The gig economy, the sharing economy, the peer-to-peer economy, these names all get used interchangeably. Do they all refer to the same thing?
For the most part, I think, if we're trying to simplify the lexicon a little bit, it's basically there are these technology platforms, apps, and websites where now you can buy a good or a service, someone's labor, without having a middle person. You just go on the app, you go on the website, and you can purchase whatever goods is being produced from a website like Etsy, where you have all these craftspeople that are making nice products. Or you can go on TaskRabbit or Upwork, and you can hire a worker to do something for you. And so this is what's generally known as this peer-to-peer economy, which is in some ways the most descriptive term of what it is, but what has become more known as the sharing economy or the gig economy.
The sharing economy, because
The idea that I have a product or a service to sell, and you want to buy that product or service, and so we can connect to each other over the internet, over technology, without having a middle person. We're in a sense sharing, though. I mean, this sort of redefines the term sharing, because it's usually not sharing as that term is commonly used. It's you're purchasing from me and I'm selling to you. So really it's more about renting, in terms of Airbnb, renting someone's house, or renting a driver from Uber or Lyft. It's a commercial transaction. So the term sharing really is not very accurate.
Well, that's calmer than you sound about it in the book. You sound really irritated at different points in the book when you talk about some of the rhetoric around the gig economy, like opportunity, collaboration, sharing. It seems to really bother you.
Well, I live in San Francisco, so that's where the earthquake central, so to speak, is of these sharing economy companies, gig economy companies. And, I, like many people, didn't really know a lot about it until I started really paying more close attention. And then when I started hearing about friends and people I know being evicted from their apartments to clear entire apartment buildings to turn them into Airbnb tourist hotels, you only have so much housing stock in any city, and you can't build housing that quickly. And so you have sort of a choice now with Airbnb. Because the technology makes it so easy to rent out, Do you want your housing stock to be used for local people and local residents who live and work there, or do you want it to be for tourists? And you can't really have both, in a sense. And so, watching what was happening to the traffic congestion in San Francisco, as well as other cities I visited, like Seattle and New York City, because of, most cities operate always at a certain level of congestion. Well, throw thousands of more cars into that congestion, which is what Uber does. They basically are trying to get as many drivers out there as they can so that your wait is short. But that creates all these knock-on effects like congestion. So I wanted to write a book that would help us to understand what is at stake here. I didn't want us to look back 20 years from now and say, wow, we didn't really understand the consequences of these new ways of working and these new types of platforms. And as a result, we didn't regulate them the correct way. So I wrote a book to really sort of make people sit up and think about it, because here in San Francisco and Silicon Valley, what you hear mostly is the Silicon Valley happy talk, which says, hey, I've got this new app, this new service, you're going to love it, I'm going to make $1 billion, what could be wrong? So I wanted to write sort of the opposite of that, so to speak, and that's what I did in this book, Raw Deal.
The book is Raw Deal, How the Uber Economy and Runaway Capitalism Are Screwing American Workers. And the person who wrote it is on the line with us, Stephen Hill, senior fellow with the think tank New America. You can be part of this conversation. Are you part of the gig economy? Do you drive for Uber or Lyft? Do you sell homemade crafts on Etsy and rent your home on Airbnb? How's it working for you? You can call us at 410-662-8780 or send us an email to midday@wypr.org. I mentioned this a minute ago, Stephen Hill. How big is the gig economy? There are conflicting numbers about how many people are working this way.
Yes, that's right. It is controversial, with people arguing on both sides of this point, is that how big is it? And so I'd make a few points about that. One, there's a lot of evidence that the way we typically count workers and how they work is not accurately counting these sorts of workers. So typically what we use is household surveys, and we actually literally interview people. How are you working? How many jobs do you have? And Larry Katz, a researcher at Harvard, has found evidence that workers are not accurately self-reporting. They are working two and three jobs, and yet they're only saying they have one job, and in part because they don't want it to be known that they're working multiple jobs. Maybe they're not reporting their income. Who knows why? But they're not accurately reporting. And then on top of that, the number of people who are being issued what's called 1099 forms by the IRS. This is the form that is used by independent contractors and freelancers when you're paying your taxes. Those forms are up about 20%. The number of people filing Schedule C, which is the form for self-employment, is up about 20%. So there's all these sorts of conflicting evidence that about how big these people, this kind of gig economy is. But the point I think we're missing here is that even when you look at, for example, regularly part-time employed workers, a lot of them today are subject to what's called just-in-time scheduling, where they can now use technology, computers to very precisely schedule people. They know when their peak demands periods are, and they can say, hey, I only need you for 3 hours on Wednesday. I only need you for 4 hours on Thursday. And so these sorts of workers aren't being given schedules 2 weeks or a month in advance. They're learning sometimes day to day when to come into work. And so they're basically on call. And so at that point, the conditions of these sorts of regularly employed part-timers is really not that different from people in the gig economy. What we have to realize is that we're looking at a spectrum of work now, how people are working. The old model was as many as possible. We wanted workers to have a full-time job for a single employer, and you're either that or you're unemployed. But now more and more workers are in between these two polar opposites, where they're working for multiple businesses. They might have a part-time job 20 hours a week here. They might supplement that with a shift on Uber, or maybe they do something for TaskRabbit or Upwork. Maybe they have two or three part-time jobs. This is how more and more Americans are working today, and yet our economic models, the way we count workers, is stuck on the old model and is not accurately reflecting what is going on out there in the labor force.
a spectrum of work. Mark has called us from Catonsville, and I think he has an insight about something along that spectrum. Mark, welcome to Midday.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call. I just want to point out that in the construction field, this has been the norm for a long time, like going back to the 70s. I started out piecework, hanging drywall. In those days, we get two and a quarter per sheet. And when you finished whatever house you were on or whatever apartment, you hoped that there was another one. Maybe there was, maybe there wasn't. And I would get 1099s from maybe four, five, six companies over that time. And then the variations on that still go on. If you see a house under construction and there's a guy digging a hole in the front yard, chances are, very good chance, that he is technically an independent contractor. Same is true of the electricians and so forth.
So, Mark, you're saying basically that what we're talking about may be a problem, but it's not new.
Not new. No, it's filtered out. Now, it's very beneficial to the boss, you know, to the investors and so forth, because it is efficient. But there's no, it's not much benefit to the worker.
Mark, I appreciate your calling. Obviously, Stephen Hill, I want you to comment on it. The first thing I'd like you to do, though, is pick up on a word that Mark used, 1099. Which is particularly relevant. It's the form on which workers are supposed to report this kind of income, as opposed to the W-2 that we get if you get if you're a full-time worker.
Yes, that's right. So for a lot of these workers, they come under a different category of federal law called independent contractors, and sometimes they're referred to as freelancers. And for these sorts of workers, they don't have the business is not responsible for giving you anything but a wage. So they don't pay for any kind of health care, Social Security, Medicare. The business doesn't even pay for injured worker compensation. So if you get injured on the job, you're on your own. Unemployment compensation, let alone paid sick leave or paid vacation. You don't have any of that. There's no safety net with these jobs. Businesses like to hire these 1099 workers because they can save about 30% on their labor costs by hiring this sort of worker rather than a regularly employed W-2 worker because, as I said, you're not paying for all these safety net costs. But for the worker, there's some flexibility, and some workers like that. But more and more workers who I talk to initially like the flexibility. After 6 months of the flexibility, you actually start looking for a little bit more job security. You'd rather have a job where you know where you're working next week or in a month from now, and you know you have a safety net underneath you. And so these sorts of 1099 workers simply don't have that. And, you know, this was a category of work that came out of the post-World War II era where the types of workers who were subjected to this condition were more like farm workers and low-wage menial workers, and there weren't that many of them in the economy. But increasingly, as more and more businesses are going to this sort of worker because they can save the 30% on their labor costs, they like to be able to hire and fire. A lot of businesses today, they want a workforce they can turn on and off like a garden hose. That's what they want. And you can understand it from their point of view why they might want that, but it really has a lot of terrible consequences for workers, for the labor force, for the consumer society, whether you have enough aggregate demand to drive your economy, and all sorts of other knock-on effects that we have to think through very carefully.
And we're going to pick up on some of those effects after a quick break. We're talking to Stephen Hill about his book, Raw Deal, How the Uber Economy and Runaway Capitalism Are Screwing American Workers. You can be part of this conversation. Is the flexibility of gig work appealing to you? And if so, why? Send us an email at midday@wypr.org or phone us at 410-662-8780. I'm Sheila Cass. Stay with us. Welcome back to Midday, everybody. I'm Sheila Cast. Is it an opportunity or an unfortunate inevitability? Are we monetizing our assets, including our free time, or feeling the pressure due to stalled wage growth? We're discussing what's called the gig economy, or the on-demand economy, and what it means for workers, employers, and the middle class. My guest is Stephen Hill, a veteran journalist, senior fellow with the nonpartisan think tank New America. His new book is Raw Deal: How the Uber Economy and Runaway Capitalism Are Screwing American Workers, published by St. Martin's Press. I want to pick up on a word that our caller Mark used a minute ago. He said it's efficient. The American economy has it surged in the 20th century through ruthlessly finding efficiency, squeezing out waste. This sort of seems like the next step in efficiency.
Well, yeah, from the business perspective, certainly it's efficient to be able to turn your workforce on and off at will. Your previous caller, Mark, he talked about the construction field, which I write about in my book, Raw Deal, because in some ways what Mark didn't mention is that in the construction industry, you actually have what could potentially be the solution to a lot of this, because a lot of those construction workers, they are working through a contract with those businesses. And those businesses, each one that the contractor works with, agrees to pay a certain amount into a fund for that worker, who then uses that fund to purchase her or his safety net. So, you know, there is a way to regulate these sorts of businesses to create not only efficiency for the business, but to make sure that the worker is not going to be left behind and just become another ore to be fed into the machine of the business. Because, you know, a lot of these Silicon Valley companies, these startups that have this business model, a fair number of them now have failed. They've gone out of business because they've discovered that, you know, if you treat workers like nothing but an ore to be fed into your business, that, you know, the quality of that ore becomes affected by whether these workers feel like they're included in the workforce, whether they're just something to be cast aside when you don't think you need them anymore. A lot of these workers for TaskRabbit, for example, and other companies like HomeJoy, which went out of business, a lot of these workers just quit showing up for their gigs because they had other gigs they could do. And so they decided that this wasn't paying enough and I wasn't being treated fairly enough, so I'm not showing up for my gig. So, you know, that's not very efficient either. So there's a lot of inefficiencies built into this sort of startup model, gig economy model, 1099 worker model that we have to really look at as more and more workers are working this way.
We had a caller. I'm not sure we still have. No, we've lost him. We had a caller who's a personal trainer and who said if the gig economy, if it works correctly, can be great. Let's talk to Jim in Timonium. He has another point to make. Jim, welcome to Midday.
Hi, Sheila. Thanks. I had a question for Mark. I think the gig economy is a great technological answer for the overregulation. Mark talks about regulation,
Stephen,
the need for regulation, et cetera. I think that he's got it all wrong. I mean, this is a response, modern day, for people like Mark trying to overregulate things.
It's Stephen Hill is the author we're talking to, and I'm sure he has something he'd like to say in response to Jim.
Sure. I mean, I'm not a big fan of regulation any more than anyone else, but the fact of the matter is that some regulations, whether it's for your air quality, your water quality, some things we do need, I believe, in order to make sure that we don't end up like China, where not only is the environment not regulated, but workers are treated horribly. For example, I'll give you an example. This one company called Upwork. Upwork is a company based here in San Francisco in Silicon Valley, and Upwork is a labor brokerage platform. They have about 250 regular employees that work for Upwork. They can use technology to oversee 10 million freelancers all around the world. These freelancers are people, they're doing occupations anywhere from graphic designers, logo designers, translators, architects, lawyers. A huge number of occupations are on this platform trying to get work. And what they can do is, you go on that platform, you can see workers from the United States, for example, saying, hey, I'd like to make about $60 an hour for this job. And there's a worker from the European Union saying, I'd like to make 60 euros an hour. And then there's workers on this platform from Thailand, India, Philippines saying, I'll take $2 an hour for the same job. And those workers are very highly trained. They have access to technology today. They can do the job. And so you're basically introducing an online auction. And you can go on that platform and watch workers bidding on the jobs. And you can see the bids going lower and lower and lower, as it creates this race to the bottom among workers around the world, where developing world workers are in direct competition with developed world workers. And on top of that, these are all contractors, so these workers aren't receiving any type of safety net. Because it's an international forum, it's really hard to enforce any kind of national laws about rest breaks or treatment of workers, discrimination in the workplace, all these sorts of types of laws that we've passed here in the U.S. going back decades are suddenly up in the air about whether they're going to apply at all to this new type of labor force working through these labor platforms like Upwork. So, sure, I wish we could just get rid of all regulation. Why not? Except for the problem that those regulations have been put there for a reason going back decades, and maybe there's some of them that are too much, too onerous. We need to cut some of them back. But to just simply get rid of them all, which is basically what these labor platforms are, in a sense, proposing, doesn't make any sense to me at all. And I think the caller, if he were subjected to some of these sorts of conditions, probably wouldn't like it very much.
Jim, I appreciate your raising the question. Let's talk to Jay in Hagerstown. Jay, welcome to Midday. Jay?
Yep, I'm here. I'm sorry.
Your question?
I'm actually a host with Airbnb, and I don't think it's, messing with the economy at all. It's actually giving opportunities for more people to expand in fields that they didn't think they would have ever had.
Jay, thanks for making that point. So, Stephen Hill, Jay says, I'm a Airbnb host. I don't see how this is screwing anyone over, to pick up the verb in the title of your book. How do you respond?
Yeah, for some hosts, it's worked out fine. And for, it's certainly been good for consumers who need a place to stay depending on the city they're going to, if you're a tourist and what have you. And so there's no question the value of this service. And I think it could be regulated in a way that would make it safe for cities and for neighborhoods. But let's not kid ourselves that there aren't serious consequences for this service. And some of them have to do with, as I mentioned earlier, in any city you have a certain amount of housing stock that has to be reserved for a certain amount for local residents. Otherwise, those local residents have no place to live, and then they have to leave the city and then commute back into the city, which creates environmental issues. In some cities where you don't have a huge amount of tourists coming in, so for Jay, I don't know what part he lives in, and maybe there's not a lot of demand for tourism and what have you. And so it might just work out just fine. It's in balance with the rest of the community, the rest of the neighborhood. But I can tell you that in city after city, whether it's San Francisco, Portland, Oregon, Seattle, Washington, New York City, I just came back from Berlin, Germany, same story. What you see is building after building in which tenants are evicted. And these tenants tend to be ones who are seniors, disabled people. People are too vulnerable to defend themselves. They don't have the money to hire a lawyer to defend themselves when a landlord decides, hey, I can double my revenue, which is what a memo from Coldwell Banker Realtors has shown to the real estate industry, that you can double your revenue by renting it out to a tourist rather than to a local person. I can double my revenue by getting rid of these people, evicting them. They're in a rent-controlled apartment, perhaps, and I can make a lot more money. And so it literally is eating away the housing stock in city after city. And in fact, independent analyses have been done of the Airbnb website. And what they have found is that at this point, 40 to 50% of the revenue for Airbnb, as well as the listings on Airbnb, come from professional real estate operatives, not regular people like Jay just renting out a spare room, if presumably that's what Jay does. But they're professional real estate operatives, some of whom have, for example, in San Francisco, dozens of properties that they control. In New York City, some of these hosts have over 200 properties that they control. These are not regular people making extra money to stay in their home. That's not what is. The Airbnb model has drifted dramatically from what it was at the beginning, which, you know, I think we can all agree at the onset, it was a pretty good idea allowing people to rent out a spare room in their home, make some extra money. But that's not what Airbnb is anymore. And here's the thing, Airbnb knows this because they know their numbers. They have their numbers more than anyone else. They can easily look on their platform and see, oh, here's a host with over 200 properties. That's obviously not the type of people we want to empower. Instead, they are protecting these professionals that have taken that platform and turned it into something that it was never intended to be. So if we put the right regulations around Airbnb, we could cut out the bad stuff that's going on and allow the good stuff, like someone like Jay, who apparently is renting out a spare room, to keep doing what he's doing.
Jay, by the way, is in Hagerstown, which is a in Western Maryland, certainly not a town with the same development pressures that you're describing in San Francisco. This is Midday on WYPR. I'm Sheila Cast, and I'm speaking with Stephen Hill about his book, Raw Deal, How the Uber Economy and Runaway Capitalism Are Screwing American Workers. Derek has called us from Baltimore. Derek, welcome to Midday.
Yes, can you hear me clearly?
Yes.
Okay, yeah, I'm the personal trainer, and let's be clear, this gig economy came from people like me who watched their parents who had been working for a particular company or the government for 25, 30 years. When the economy crashed, people lost tens of thousands of dollars, their high life savings, their homes. So it looked like all that loyalty was rewarded with very little. So with the gig economy, you'll make a little less, but you seem to control your destiny a little bit more. And yeah, there could be some more regulations, but at the same time, for a millennial like myself, working for a large company, we don't trust the security that is advertised, even if you will start off making more money. So, and even if, one more thing, quickly, even if you do work for that company, what a lot of people are doing now, even at a place like the CIA, you'll work there for a couple of years, and then you'll go somewhere else when you can make three times the salary that you did at the government or a private institution.
Derek, I appreciate the points you made. And Stephen Hill, before I ask you to respond to them, let me add an email we got from Rashida, who said, the gig economy is actually helping me while the American economy has screwed me. I am a stay-at-home mom by choice since my husband and I opt for homeschooling our children. Parents are devalued in this economy. No paid maternity or paternity leave or child care or decent education can consume an entire paycheck. Work-from-home gigs with the help of Obamacare keep us financially afloat and able to spend time with our children. So, Stephen Hill, what would you say both to Derek, the personal trainer, who says gig economy works for him, and Rashida, a stay-at-home mom, who says the gig economy works for her?
Well, you know, I mean, Rashida said that the traditional economy has let them down, and Derek has said the same thing, and I wouldn't argue that at all. And if the gig economy is working for you, then great. But, I mean, Rashida, the things that she enumerated, that how the traditional economy is letting her down, doesn't provide parental care, parental support, and these sorts of things, the gig economy doesn't give any of that at all. And what Rashida said was that she's basically making some extra money from home, and she has another breadwinner who's making the big source of the income for her household. And so that's one of the nice features about the gig economy, is that you can make some extra money. But let's not kid ourselves to think that this somehow can be the basis for a real economy. We know that in the 2008 economic collapse that happened, a lot of the good jobs that we had in this economy went away. And in the aftermath, in this very lukewarm recovery that we've had, a fifth of the new jobs created have been temp jobs. About half of the jobs don't pay any more than minimum wage. And so basically the good jobs have been replaced by these sort of crummy jobs where the pay is low, there's no safety net protection, workers don't have any job security at all. So this to just give up on having a better economy and sort of get satisfied with having a gig from here to there, I don't see that that's going to be a future for very many people. I mean, I was at this event recently where there was a lot of millennials there. And, you know, everyone was talking about the millennials this, millennials that, and someone said, well, we have some millennials in the room. Why don't we ask them how it's working for them? And to make a long story short, as each one of them talked, as they got older and older, so the ones who were in their mid-20s, late-20s, they were saying like, yeah, I'm working this gig economy. I don't mind going from job to job. It's working okay for me. But then as someone got into their early 30s and even into their mid-30s, they said, well, you know, I did that for a number of years, but now you know, I'd like to have a little bit more job security. I'd like to stay at one place, start accumulating some savings. I'd like to start thinking about buying a home. I have a partner now. We're talking about getting married. As you get older, you start wanting more stability. And that's when my fear is that for this generation of millennials, they're going to discover the good jobs that their parents and grandparents had don't exist for them anymore. And they're going to get very tired of always juggling a number of gigs through this gig economy because it wears you out. You spend a huge amount of time looking for your next job. You don't have any type of security. You might have a job for 2 hours, two days, 2 weeks, and then you have to continually, in your spare time, look for the next job. This is not something that we can really base an economy on going forward, I don't believe. And so, you know, for Derek and Rashida, if it's working for them, great. But they might find as they get older, or if they don't have someone who's making enough income in their household already, they're just relying on their own income, that at a certain point, the gig economy is going to get pretty old pretty fast. I've seen that in worker after worker who I've interviewed for this book. They start saying like, you know, in the beginning, this was working okay for me, including Uber drivers. I mean, Uber's own numbers show that about 50% of Uber drivers last a year on that platform. And then they move on because they realize, you know, this has been okay for a while, but it's really not a way that I can make a good living going forward.
Before we take our last break, take just a minute to tell us about your own experience in the gig economy.
My experience?
Yeah.
Well, I haven't really had much experience at doing gig work per se, as that term is defined, but I have had a lot of work being a freelancer. I come out of the think tank world, Policy Institute world. And in 2010, I became a freelancer. And at first it was like, you know, this is good. I have a lot of flexibility. I've made a lot of contacts through my previous job. I can leverage those to make some good money. And, you know, it seemed like it was a good thing initially. But also I started realizing, you know, I'm now responsible for my own health care. I also now have to pay the employer's half of Social Security and Medicare, which Derek and Rashida didn't mention, assuming they are paying it. If they're not paying it, it's that they're actually operating illegally. But as a gig economy worker, as an independent contractor or freelancer, you have to pay now the employer's half of Social Security and Medicare, which is another 8% gone from your pay right there off the top. You don't have access to a company or a business or a workplace that gives you infrastructure. So you have to pay for your own infrastructure, whether it's a home office or internet connection or what it is. So there's just a lot of unintended, unforeseen situations that occur when you're working this way that, you know, can be pretty vexing sometimes. I mean, if you're making enough income. So in Silicon Valley, there are lots of workers working freelance and they're getting paid $100, $200 an hour for some of the things they're doing. So you can save enough money to hold you over during the lean times when you aren't finding work. But for a lot of these gig economy workers and freelancers and contractors, you know, they're making barely minimum wage, or maybe they're making $15, $20 an hour. You don't have a lot of margin there when you don't have work and income coming in. And so that's what I experienced as being a freelancer. I mean, when I hear a lot of people who are, you know, certain professors and academics who are saying like, oh, this gig economy could work just fine. And I think, yeah, that's easy to say. You've got a regular employee job, you have a regular salary, you have health care, you have a safety net through your university, or, you know, some of the Silicon Valley CEOs and business leaders saying like, oh, this is going to be great, you're going to love it. Yeah, well, you have a great paying job. This is, you know, I think we have to really think about the ramifications of this way of working, because there are
and
a lot
we'll
of
talk
problems
more. We'll talk more about the implications after we take this quick break. We'll continue our conversation on the gig economy and the changing nature of work. Plus, talk about a potential solution to provide economic stability for contract workers. You can be part of this conversation. Call us at 410-662-8780. Send us an email at midday@wypr.org. I'm Sheila Cass. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Midday, everybody. I'm Sheila Cast. I'm speaking with Stephen Hill, senior fellow with the nonpartisan think tank New America and author of Raw Deal, How the Uber Economy and Runaway Capitalism Are Screwing American Workers. Do you worry about the future of employee benefits like health care, retirement, workers' comp? Do you think the gig economy threatens those benefits? We're taking calls at 410-662-8780, emails at midday@wypr.org. We got an email from John who says, in part, the gig economy continues a long-term trend of shifting risk from institutions to individuals. Although high-income gig workers may enjoy lots of benefits, others will be crushed. Just wait for the retirement years of the gig economy as tens of millions become destitute while the 1% flourish. That's an email from John. Don has phoned us from Bel Air. Don, welcome to Midday.
Thank you very much. I'm wondering what role the collapse of labor unions has played in all of this. I do voiceovers for a living, and if I join SAG-AFTRA, I'll make more per gig, but I'm severely limiting the opportunities that I've got. As it is now, I'm spending probably 80% of my time marketing and 20% in front of a mic.
You're spending how much of your time marketing?
Probably 80% of my time.
Wow. Okay, Don, I appreciate your calling us. Stephen, what would you say to Don?
Well, that's a very typical story I hear from worker after worker who's trying to make a living freelancing, contracting, gig economy, is that they spend a huge amount of time looking for the next job. And this is... this is a real radical transformation of how people work. I mean, it's sort of like as if, you know, LeBron James or Steph Curry only get paid whenever they make a basket. They don't get paid for the rest of the game. In this type of work, you only get paid when you deliver the product and when you, you don't get paid for any training. You don't get paid for... standing around the water cooler with coworkers. You don't get paid to go to a meeting. You're only paid for when you deliver the product that you've been hired to produce. And, you know, for some workers, this kind of relationship can work out okay. I mean, some workers are very good at being entrepreneurial and hustling for the next gig. But for others, they're very talented, very skilled, very experienced. But being a hustler, being an entrepreneur is not a talent that they necessarily possess. Maybe they can learn it over time, but some people are just naturally better at this sort of thing. I mean, the beauty of the post-World War II economy that we've had is that many different types of workers could plug in some place and find a decent type of job that pays well, gave them a level of security. The gig economy and this kind of new way of the digital economy of independent, relying on independent contractors and freelancers, it's turning everyone into, you know, I mean, in fact, they say you've got to be the CEO of your own business. I mean, Uber says you're the CEO of your own driving business. And that's just ridiculous rhetoric coming out of Silicon Valley, because there's nothing CEO-like about it. You don't, CEOs make a ton of money and have good health benefits and security. You know, the average gig worker who is supposed to be the CEO of her or his own business, you are particularly subject to like rating systems and all sorts of other ways in which they basically let you know you don't have any control over your platform, over what you're doing. You really are subjected to these market forces.
But so, Don's first question or point was that the being in a union would make it more difficult for him to put together the income he does put together in this gig economy.
He said he would get paid more, but more people aren't hiring. If you're with the union, they won't hire you, is what I understood him to be saying. And sure, that's a big problem. I mean, unions, I have a chapter in my book about labor unions and what has happened to labor unions. And, you know, it's a long discussion, but the short version of it is that a lot of labor unions have lost the leverage they have with these employers because of things like the independent contractor loophole, because of freelancer loophole. I mean, if you go to an auto plant today, 50% of the workers working in that plant are temp workers, even though they're doing the exact same job as the regularly employed workers. Right next alongside of them, they're getting half the pay. They have virtually no safety net and no job security. So this is the bigger picture of what's happening to our economy that the gig economy now is moving into. And so that's why we have to understand these new types of jobs in the context of what's happening to the overall economy.
Don, thanks for the call. Stephen Hill, you mentioned hustling, and that in my mind raises another point that I want to make. Lester Spence, who is associate professor of political science and Africana studies at Johns Hopkins University, says that the trend that you're talking about hits the Black community especially hard. He published his book, Knocking the Hustle, Against the Neoliberal Turn in Black Politics, last winter. And when we talked in January, I asked him why a certain amount of hustling to make ends meet is not okay. Here's part of what Lester Spence told me.
Folks are hustling to maintain, right? Right? They're not hustling like, you know, to make enough money so they can buy a third car. They're hustling in order to keep up the payments on the car they have, in order to keep up their house note. Right now, and nobody can knock that. Right. So who would? So the Uber driver, you know, I really don't like Uber. Sometimes I'm quote unquote forced to use it. The Uber driver who has to make ends meet. Right. I'm not knocking the choice that individual makes. What I'm suggesting, though, is that what we've done is we naturalize the hustle. That is, we've made it such that thing is the natural thing that people do. It's the norm. And if you don't act according to that norm, you're the one with the problem. And anything that happens to you is your fault.
Stephen Hill, your thoughts on Lester Spence's insights, especially how the gig economy plays in underprivileged neighborhoods.
Yeah, I agree with Lester. I mean, it on the one hand, it provides some measure of opportunity. If you don't have any work and you can make some work doing this and it's working for you, then fine. It's hard to criticize individual choices. But we can't fool ourselves to think that this is somehow going to be a big win for the economy, that the good jobs that went away in the 2008-2009 collapse are being replaced by these sorts of jobs. It's just, you know, and you will have issue of going forward of, you know, our economy is 70% driven by consumer demand. If not enough people have enough money in their pockets to buy up the goods and services the economy is producing, then businesses don't have customers. They have to start laying people off, and then people drift into the gig economy. And we're already seeing this dynamic at work in this economy today.
We are down to just a few minutes, and I don't want to let the hour pass without talking about what kind of solutions you see, if any, to the trend that worries you so much.
Yeah, thank you for giving me a chance to talk about that, because I do have two chapters in the book. In fact, in some ways, it's the core of the book. The rest of the book is leading up to these two chapters to say, what do we do about it? And so there's a number of things that I propose, but the most important one is I propose that we create what's called a portable safety net. So what we can do for each worker is we set up an individual security account. And each business that hires that worker pays a certain amount of money above the wage that is prorated to the number of hours that worker works for that business. It doesn't matter if the worker is working for the business as a freelancer, a contractor, or a regularly employed worker. Either way, the business pays a certain amount into this individual security account that would then be used by that worker to purchase her or his safety net. It could go into existing infrastructure such as Social Security, Medicare, Obamacare, all these sorts of things would allow this worker to go from job to job, which so many workers are doing today, and at each job collect a certain amount that goes towards their security.
Let me
this
make
is
sure
what
I understand.
They have done in the carpentry industry, in the construction and trades, as your first caller alluded to. This is what they've done for years, and this is what we now have to evolve the rest of our economy into a system like this.
So this account would replace for 1099 workers, this account would replace Social Security and
No, so this would be separate, a separate account. The business would pay into this account, and then some of that money that goes into that account would then be would be used for the workers' contribution to Social Security, to Medicare, to Obamacare. They would some of it could go into the unemployment fund and into the injured worker fund. So it would be a catch-all account that would collect the funds that would go into already existing infrastructure that we have for safety net, but these workers can't afford or aren't eligible for because currently they are 1099 workers.
It is hard for me to picture that. Well, first of all, you'd need government to set this up, correct?
You would. You need to pass legislation. But here's the thing. We could do this at the local or state level. We don't have to wait for the U.S. Congress, which seems to be permanently paralyzed these days, to pass this. A local government could pass a law saying all of our businesses now are going to pay into an individual security account set up for each worker in our city. For example, in San Francisco, they have a system that's similar to this called healthcare accounts, where each business that isn't already providing healthcare for their workers has to pay into a healthcare account that then that worker can use to purchase healthcare. So this is basically doing the exact same thing, but doing it for other components of the safety net.
How would you get employers on board?
Well, we're already finding a lot of employers in Silicon Valley are saying, you know what, I recognize we have a problem here, and I'm willing to have this discussion. In fact, I was part of an effort that led to 40 business, labor, and NGO leaders signing a statement of principles calling for portable benefits for workers. And these were businesses like Lyft, other Silicon Valley companies that signed on to this statement of principles. So I think that more and more businesses are realizing we have a problem. I mean, sort of go. The problem, interestingly, goes back to the old story about Henry Ford. You know, once was Henry Ford II was giving a tour of his new auto plant to Walter Reuther, the head of the United Auto Workers. He was showing Walter all of his robots. And he said, "Walter, how are you going to get union dues out of these robots?" And Walter, without missing a beat, said, "Henry, how are you going to get them to buy your cars?" This is the dilemma that the economy is facing, and that businesses are facing. If the wages aren't high enough and the protections for workers aren't good enough, workers aren't going to have the discretionary income to buy the goods and services that this economy is producing. So even as a business person, you won't have customers.
You have given us a lot to think about this hour. I really appreciate the conversation. Thank you.
It's been my pleasure, Sheila. Thank you for having me on.
Stephen Hill, senior fellow with the think tank New America. His book is Raw Deal, How the Uber Economy and Runaway Capitalism Are Screwing American Workers, published by St. Martin's Press. Lunch for midday guests is provided by Dangerously Delicious Pies, with locations at 2839 O'Donnell Street on the Square in Canton and 810 West 36th Street in Hamden. Their menu includes a variety of homemade sweet and savory pies and quiches. On the web at dangerouspiesbalt.com. Glad you've been with us today. Tune in tomorrow, ready to entertain the idea that a lot of what you think you know about recycling could be wrong. We'll speak with an economist who says that for some items, including plastic, it doesn't make environmental or financial sense to recycle. I'm Sheila Cast. Have a great afternoon.
Midday is produced by Maureen Harvey and Andrea Appleton. The show is engineered by Luke Spicknall. Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcasts and live streaming are available at WYPR.org or on demand using the WYPR app. This is WYPR, your NPR news station.